Stephen, introduce yourself to people. You're coming on as a bet. I mean, we were going to bet on who would win the election, and it turns out I won. But I decided to honor the bet as if I had lost and have you on. So at least it looks like I've won. Although, you know, not the fat lady hasn't sung quite yet. But
yeah, that's true.
But yeah, so just to start with, what are you hoping to talk about today when it comes to Trump and maybe the election, but also the bigger picture of American politics?
We've covered a lot of ground in our conversations, so you know, I'm not kind of sure where you want to follow up on, and we've introduced a lot of topics.
I could start with just who you are. I mean, where do you live, and not, you know, not your exact address, but what part of the country do you live in? Because I tell you why I asked that is because there's been a lot of talk about the rural urban divide, and it seems like you have a conservative perspective.
Yeah. I'm in the Midwest in Indiana.
Uh-huh.
And I'm what I would call a moderate, conservative, constitutional. I'm into the Constitution and the tenets of that: sound money, small government, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I guess the best way professionally to see me is as an inventor. I've been doing that for a long time. And
what kinds of things have you invented?
I have three inventions. The first one was a windmill, and that's a patent anybody can look up. I got a patent on that. And the number is 5909859. So if anybody wants to look, that's public record.
Mm-hmm.
You can go to Google Patents. My second invention is my house. You can kind of see a little bit.
So I'm curious to know how you came to be interested in what I'm doing. How did you find out about me? Was it because I was on Thaddeus Russell's program? Was that how you found out about me, or
you know, I might have met you kind of through Thaddeus. I'm not sure. Basically, what I undertook an effort to kind of get caught up in philosophy. Mm-hmm. So this might be helpful in getting to my background. And you talk a lot about how you only have a bachelor's in philosophy, and I know you're talking to a lot of doctorates. And I have a minor in philosophy. So I studied philosophy for 2 years, along with a marketing degree.
Right.
But that was 30 years ago. And I kind of got two things out of my schooling that I think is really important. I was really fascinated with postmodernism.
Mm-hmm.
So I've really been, I think the number one attribute of an inventor is curiosity. I have a ravenous curiosity. I read a lot. So I'm really up on postmodernism, kind of on a casual level. I read everything I could find about it over that time.
Thaddeus is considers himself to be a postmodern as well. Do you like postmodernism? Would you embrace postmodernism, or are you more of a critic of it?
You know, I think it's a reality. I wouldn't really say that I'm friend or foe to it. I just think of it as skepticism too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as we kind of overturn different scientific discoveries, and this is, you know, the fundamental problem with language, where you have to grasp something concrete, but yet there's always a doubt.
The conversation about standards of evidence was one that we could, like, if we really wanted to do it seriously, we could have a conversation about it like two or three times, maybe a whole course. But let's just assume for a moment that we have similar standards of evidence. So like we have a basic kind of workaday critical faculty, and we can toss around claims without worrying too much about, you know, sharing the same narrative frame, or basically assume that we can't rely on narrative frames, that we're going to have to look at specific evidence. We're going to have to look at what the deductive arguments are, and test them to see if they're true. And I'll get us started. Like know that the frame from on the left right now is that here's the frame around the election. Trump has been planning to do a coup for many, many months. He's known all along he was likely to lose. He doesn't want to accept his loss, and therefore he's, for no reason other than it's in his own interest, claiming that there's voter fraud wherever it suits him. That's the left-wing frame.
Okay.
What's the right-wing one? I'll state the right-wing one. The right-wing one is Democrats do cheat. You can look to history. There are examples of the Democratic cheating. One that comes to mind is Nixon versus Kennedy back in 1960. More recently than that, in Iowa, there seemed to be a lot of evidence of tinkering with the results around Bernie Sanders. I think he won Iowa pretty clearly, but they stopped the vote and they messed around, and it kind of got, there were obvious errors that never got corrected and things, so that it became unclear whether it was him or Buttigieg. And it seems possible to me that there might be some voter fraud. So the right wing, but the right wing narrative would be there's definitely voter fraud. Not only that, the people who are running the Democratic Party are aligned with demonic forces. They're, you know, QAnon would say that they're maybe alien pedophiles, and Donald Trump is on a mission to expose them, and this is their final play to get rid of him through voter fraud, and so that would be the right-wing narrative. I think it's a little bit more unhinged than the left-wing one, but neither of them are being as skeptical as they ought to be about the evidence, right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I guess I would point to the fact that the idea that there's not voter fraud is probably not even credible. I mean, because
it's a childish notion. Yeah, there's always voter fraud.
There's always people attacking things. So, you can almost go back to the Russia hoax narrative where they were saying, you know, they were always saying that Russia was interfering with the election. Well, of course they're interfering with the election. The question is, did they really interfere a lot more than they usually do, or were they? Right.
Yeah.
So it's the same way with the voter fraud, I would think, that we know there is some voter fraud, probably on both sides. I mean,
yeah, there was voter suppression on the side of the Republicans, and there's votes inflation in one way or another, probably on the side of the Democrats.
So the question becomes then, is there a lot more than usual? I mean, is this kind of just your garden variety usual thing? I think there's likely to be more, because I'm looking back at just what they've been doing since Trump was elected. You know, what we know, about the Obamagate and the Flynn.
Friend of the show, journalist Matt Taibbi, he's tracked Russiagate story very closely from the very beginning, and he joins us now via Skype. Matt, thanks for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Matt, just react. I mean, maybe break down some of your own analysis here. As I understand it, I mean, the FBI general counsel, they basically decided and said openly, should we lie, or do we want him to lie to actually tell the truth, or do we want to trick him so we can charge him later? I mean, really explosive stuff there.
It really is. This case is, you have to, in the broad strokes, what happened was Flynn was responding to Barack Obama imposing a range of sanctions against the Russians in late December of 2016. He spoke to the Russian ambassador, and essentially what he said was, hey, don't overreact. Wait till we get in office. Don't go crazy. You know, it's not going to be so bad when we come into office. And that conversation was captured. It was being monitored. It was leaked to the Washington Post, I think illegally, by the way. And then subsequently, the FBI interviewed Flynn and asked him about that conversation. And on the basis of that interview, he was prosecuted for lying to the FBI, not for anything that he actually said to Kislyak, but for his conduct in the interview. And now the thing that's explosive about these new revelations is not only that the FBI was debating with itself over whether or not they're trying to get him to lie or whether they want to get him fired or what. But if you look at the transcript, it says things like, should we show him the redacted which I think means the transcript. In other words, they didn't even confront him with what he actually said. They just sort of waited for him to say things in the hopes that he would lie. It looks
wow.
like.
I mean, that's huge. To me, the idea that just gets glossed over, that I'm trying to say, well, there might be voter fraud, and the Democrats and the left are just saying, oh, no, you know, there's it doesn't even seem credible to me that you can not suspect it looking back on what they've been doing. I mean, from the time he went down the elevator, pretty much, we know that was a setup, the Russiagate. So, I mean, they spent 22 million, whatever it was, and the 3 years. I mean, imagine, think about the cost to our country. And then the impeachment. I mean, the impeachment process is designed to minimize the damage, that if we do have a bad president, a crooked president, in a way that removes this guy without damaging the country. And if you look at the way the impeachment process for Donald Trump was executed, it was the exact opposite. You know, they were trying to prosecute him in the public eye by doing as much damage. So you have all the damage from the Russiagate. You have the damage from the impeachment. So if you look at this history going up, it's hard not to think, well, why wouldn't you suspect that something might be going on?
Yeah.
So, you know, based on what I'm seeing, I like to think of myself.
Well, tell me some of the best pieces of evidence, like, that you've seen. Because I've seen one real piece of evidence that showed that there might be voter fraud in Michigan and in Wisconsin. And it was these charts where...
I think I shared that one.
Yeah, you may have shared it with me. Other people, I've seen it other places as well. There was a big influx of Biden votes late into the night or early morning of the election of November 4th, early morning. And it was a spike up for Biden, and there was no spike for Trump. And you wouldn't necessarily think there should be an equal spike. I mean, clearly Biden could get there could be a whole bunch of new votes tallied all at once. That seems fine. And there could be a big spike for Biden, and he could come up a long way. But you would expect to see some sort of increase in Trump's line at the same time, because even if it was just only 10% of the votes or 5% of the votes were for Trump that came in that batch, there would still be a blip up. Now, there are a couple of explanations as to why there wasn't. It was a really low percentage for Trump in that batch of votes, and low enough so that it doesn't really show up very well on the line graph, due to the way the line graph is measuring things, that you know, you need a finer scale to see the blip. That's a possibility. That was my first thought. But then it turned out I looked into the Michigan case, and there was just human error, that there was a comma in the wrong place when it was reported to the media, and what should have been a 10,000 vote increase for Biden was showing as a 100,000 vote increase for Biden, and that it was later corrected. And that the vote totals that we're seeing now don't reflect what we're seeing in that chart that's being passed around.
And really, how are you going to know, right? I mean,
well,
it's not like we're there or we know someone there. We're just watching the screen and information's coming in, right?
Right. I mean, I can't know for sure whether or not that's true, except in so much as I can look into, in the one case in Michigan, and it's only Michigan that I have an answer for, they did show two different graphs, and you can go and check out and look for yourself to see that there was a correction made on the website, right? And that the vote total is different now than it had been at that point. But you can't know that since now we've got a vote total that's so much higher than it was even when Biden got that spike, that it doesn't. Mm-hmm. You can't know that it doesn't, that really doesn't include those votes. You can just know that at some point there was a correction made but at that point, if you can't take it for granted that the correction was made when there's photographic evidence of it, then you can't know that the original evidence was real either. And you know,
right.
So I'm going to take it for granted that that the first draft does show a real spike that came in due to faulty reporting in Michigan. And then the question for me, if I was being diligent, I would say, okay, what about the Wisconsin spike that I've seen? What's the explanation? Well, but I haven't done that yet.
I would point to the turnout in Wisconsin. And, you know, the record turnout before I heard was 72.3%. That was the best they've ever done before. This time it was 89%. And I know there was a lot of interest that we expected high turnout, but
that's a lot. Yeah, it is a lot. But nationwide, it was something like 70% of the population voted. That's highest since 1940. It was historic.
Right.
And it's so because of mail-in ballots, which make it easier to vote. And more people being, frankly, unemployed and not being away from not being at work instead of voting. So those are the two things that I think would explain it. It's the same reason why there's so many riots.
Yeah.
Because people aren't at work. So they have less time to go out.
But even so, that seems extreme. I mean, if you figured, let's say 80% was the actual turnout, you could, or 79, yeah, I mean, you could look at a number that's showing something like 10% of those ballots could be fraudulent. That might be like 100,000 votes that dropped in there, and he's only leading there by 20,000 votes or something.
Okay, so let's say that there is voter fraud, or there's a possibility of voter fraud. That at the moment, we have to be open to the idea that and because of the increase in voter participation that seems abnormal, and because of the increase in vote by mail, which doesn't have to be more exposed to the possibility of fraud, but might be in a time of COVID when it's being implemented quickly, right? Might be less secure. Let's just say, and also because of the photographic evidence in the graph charts in the line graphs, that there's at least one example of a spike that we haven't fully explained away. Let's say that, okay, we have to remain open to the possibility that vote fraud occurred. At this point, I'm likely to turn to the court's decisions. He's filing for lawsuits in Georgia, in Michigan, Wisconsin, and in Pennsylvania. And he's waiting for the vote in Arizona to come in. So when in Wisconsin, I think it was, or maybe it was in Georgia, but in one case, the judge said, look, you haven't presented ample evidence. You don't have evidence of vote fraud. Therefore, we're not going to honor your request for a lawsuit. We're dismissing this out of hand.
Mm-hmm.
I trust the courts to be a good judge of evidence.
Yeah, I wish we could, but unfortunately, there's a lot of evidence that we can't trust them. I mean, look at the Flynn case, where the DOJ was trying to drop the case. And now that it's been exposed that Flynn was set up blatantly, DOJ is trying to drop the case. And you got a liberal judge, Solomon's his last name, Emmett Solomon, if you look at what's going on there, I would recommend Viva.
I have not really looked deeply into that, but when it comes to Michael, remember the Michael Brown killing?
Yes.
So when it came to the Michael Brown killing, I was probably unique on the left of saying, look, we have our narrative that we think is true, but we have to have some epistemic humility and say, even though the courts are imperfect, they're better judge of evidence than we can be from where we're sitting. Therefore, we should, grant to them the right to be the final arbiter about this evidence. In the case of Michael Brown, that meant that he was not shot in cold blood by the police officer, but was attacking the cop. Whether or not we think that we don't, that doesn't mean we have to say, and I think it was this guy's name was Darrell Wilson, the police officer. We don't have to say Darrell Wilson was completely justified, or that, that there weren't other options, or that we don't want to impose new regulations on the cops after this. We can, but we might, but we're not judging whether or not the policies are adequate. We're judging whether or not Darryl Wilson was guilty of murder. Right. And that's a separate judgment. And if we ask that question, well, then it looks like, according to the courts who have a better access to evidence than we do, that the answer is no, he was not guilty of murder. And I would say the same thing about to Trump supporters who are wondering about voter fraud. I'd say, look, the courts are going to decide. They're going to look at the evidence. They're going to have better access to the evidence than we do. You can point to some cases where you think you have more evidence than the judge does and you can see bias. Okay. That doesn't mean that you're now sitting in a better position than the courts are to judge this case. And overall, we can say the courts are, you know, having a systemic process by which they actually do judge evidence, having rules in place by which they do judge evidence. They're much better off than we are in this wild west of social media trying to figure out what's true. Yeah,
I would agree with that. But on the other hand, we're almost getting back to this idea of the experts where we just turn things over and believe the experts. And there's times you can believe the experts and there's times you shouldn't believe the experts.
I think there's a difference between believing the experts and believing that the court of law has institutional authority to adjudicate these.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. But it's not inconceivable that there could be problems there. And there are systems, checks of balances in place to, you know, it's not like they just have free reign to do anything they want. They have laws to follow. They have rules to follow.
Absolutely. And if they're not following the rules, that should come out. Like a good lawyer and PR person for Trump, if the courts are cheating, they should be able to document that and provide that information to the public. Whether or not justice will prevail, as I can't say, but at least then we'll have some evidence and you can judge the evidence based on what's put out. But unfortunately, Trump isn't good about this at all.
He comes up and says,
you know, right at the start before those spikes occurred. Okay. You know, around 2:30 in the morning and before there were these spikes on the graphs, he's saying already there was vote fraud in Philadelphia just because he'd heard that there could be possibly that's coming. I mean, I trust that the presidential campaign has better information than the public does. Like it turns out that if you're going to ask someone what the results of the election are going to be, you're better off asking someone who's working for the political campaigns than you are asking Nate Silver. Right? Working off of public polls. Like I trust probably the internal polls of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party more than I trust Nate Silver now. So I can imagine Trump had some knowledge that it was going to be very close. And that was informed his strategy to talk about vote fraud, because if it was coming down to very, very tight margins, then at that point, voter fraud would be a real live issue.
Right. I mean, the Electoral College is really hard to cheat, assuming there's pretty good margins. But the closer it gets, the easier it is. And really, you're looking at two levels here. You're looking at the fact that, OK, let's say there's voter fraud going on and they're trying to find it. They may find some. They're going to find some because, as we've already talked about, there's going to be some. There's always people trying to do that. Mm-hmm. But then there's a whole other level of trusting the people who are going to look into it. I mean, there's a lot of allegations of, I know that the GOP is claiming that in Pennsylvania, they were not, Giuliani, I just saw him come out and say that the Republicans didn't get to see any of those mail-in ballots at all. That, you know, they were, I've seen pictures of them putting cardboard up on the windows so they couldn't see. And I heard about court orders where they were ordered to be able to see and they still weren't able, you know,
so what would the consequence be of that being demonstrated to be true? A recount?
Man, I don't know. I mean, I could almost see almost having to do a revote. I guess I don't know.
Why would there need to be a revote?
Just kind of to make sure.
I mean, it seems to me that if the poll watchers could be there at the original count to stop fraud, that the poll watchers could be then allowed in during a recount to stop fraud. Well, and if there was fraud the first time, then the poll watchers could stand there and oversee the recount the second time and catch it the second time when they didn't the first because they weren't allowed to. Also, you're going to say something like a lot of votes may have been thrown out for Trump.
Exactly. I mean, if the Republicans were locked out for that amount of time, how do you know? I mean, if you got a big let's go back to the idea in Michigan that there was a big drop of just Biden votes. I mean, what if they took the votes, separated them by Biden and Trump, so they knew which were won, and then dropped all the Biden votes in and just threw away the Trump votes?
You know, look, I can see why you'd want a recount, a revote, but I think the best thing to do is to look up what the law says.
And you got the powers that be. They're going to do their best to find the fraud, and then they're going to run their course.
Because
perfect, you know,
and I mean, with any vote, there's always going to be an opening. I mean, like I've been hearing for years on the left, because since Al Gore and Bush, there's been this feeling, and then in 2004 with Kerry, there was a feeling pervasive on the left that the Republicans were cheating like crazy and that they were doing it through electronic voting. Mm-hmm. And that came up again in Iowa.
And it came up in Michigan. They were saying that there was a glitch that flipped that county, and that that type of polling machine was prevalent in Michigan and in Georgia. So, you know.
Yeah. So
it's a mess.
Yeah.
Going on.
Yeah. I mean, the truth is that the voting in America is a mess in general. Like, not only is it a mess because it's not secure enough, and anyone in tech will tell you electronic voting is not secure. It just isn't, right?
Yep.
But it's also a mess because there are different standards all over the, you know, not just state by state, but county by county, right? So
I think you need federal standards to ever. Where
yeah, I think
on. That
federal standards and securing
need
the vote.
So
that would be a useful thing, if not so much because we could, just so that these kinds of questions don't arise. And if you want to take it from the perspective of an anti-Trump person, you could say, look, if we secured the vote, then someone like Trump couldn't point vaguely at fraud and then have everyone who looked into it find out, yeah, he's right. There's tons of reasons or ways that there could be fraud. Even if there wasn't in this case, the climate around voting right now, because of how messed up it all is such that it provides an opportunity for someone who wants to cast doubt on any election, right?
Right.
So yeah, we both agree that at this moment, what we should try to work on going forward, just on the most practical level, is security of the vote. But let's talk about the fact that voter fraud always kind of goes on in the background, and how probably campaigns know that and kind of try to run their campaigns to overcome that, to get margins that overcome that difficulty. I mean, the truth is that if it was really close, but like, for instance, with Clinton, when it was really close and Democrats would complain about the reason that Trump won was because of voter suppression, I would say, okay, but Hillary Clinton knew that there was going to be some voter suppression going in, and she didn't run a good enough campaign to overcome it, and therefore she lost. And we should stop bitching and moaning and whining, and we should try to figure out why we lost.
So the same thing
applies to Trump now, right? Like, you know, okay, so there was maybe some votes that were inflated, but Trump knew that going in. Why didn't he run a campaign that could overcome that, where there was so much support for him that, you know, that they couldn't, a few little shenanigans couldn't keep him from the White House? Why was it so close?
I've definitely heard arguments that Trump really did. I mean, if you look at the gains in the House and the Senate, or holding the Senate, and the progress in the minority vote. As a matter of fact, that even feeds into the idea that there was more likely voter fraud. When you look at all the progress, there was a trend overall in the country, and yet in those areas, in those few areas, that seem to buck the trend. And these are democratically controlled areas in general. I think all but Arizona Arizona was the first one. Look,
I think that those sorts of explanation that you offer, like, okay, one way to conceive of the fact that Trump didn't do as well as down ballot Republicans in lots of places is to say, well, the ballots were fixed for Biden, or that some Biden votes are just phony in some areas.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't bother to phony up votes for their own, for other Democrats in those areas.
Right. Yeah. But, I heard that.
But you'd have to then say, like, what's the, like, are there more Biden votes than there were ballots or registered voters? You know, like,
I've seen some stuff that points to that. You know, again, I have no idea. I mean, when you have more, right. That would be a clear sign of fraud, right?
Right. So I would say that if those things are happening, certainly the Trump campaign would be in a better position to know it and gather the evidence than you and I are, and that they should be able to gather that evidence and then present it to the relevant courts in Pennsylvania and probably in Michigan and Wisconsin, right? That's that's where they'll do it. If when they do that, the courts reject their claims, I wouldn't chalk that up to a Democratic conspiracy. I think at that point, you're starting to leave the realm. You have an unfalsifiable claim. You know, if nobody can be an arbiter and judge of the evidence and prove you wrong, then, you know, you're not really talking about reason. You're talking about dogma. Like, it's already an established fact that the voter fraud happened. Now, the same's true of the left. I mean, most people on the left would say, no, there's no voter fraud at all. And if any court takes it up, then they're in the bag for Donald Trump. Right.
Right.
I don't believe that's true either. I really have gotten to a point, and I feel blessed by this, that I don't care who wins the election. I do not have a dog in the fight anymore. I watching the exit polls come in to show that the only people that Trump lost with over the last election were white men, and he gained with every kind of minority in the country, sort of was eye opening. And then you also throw in the fact that it was as close as it was. 69 million people voted for him. They can't all be Nazis, you know? so that's important to realize. Seeing that the rural city divide seems to be very consequential. That's important for me as someone who wants to bring people together, to change society, that this divide is.
Well, I think we should talk about the media.
Talk about the media.
I mean, that's huge, because look at the way the election turned out, where it was pretty clear that Trump had won Florida and Texas pretty early on. And it was almost as if the media wanted to always make sure that Biden was ahead. So they waited until Biden kind of got enough votes that were say, okay, we can now release Florida and Biden will still be ahead. The fact that Arizona flipped so soon, and that was.
Yeah, that was a mistake. I think Arizona may very well go back to Trump. I would expect, I almost expect that. It may not, but it could.
And it's huge that they called it that early. It was almost as if they cheated there and knew, so they knew that they thought they could call it or something.
Yeah, but it was Fox that called it.
Yeah, but that's the thing, Fox. You got to remember, too, that Trump is hated almost equally among Democrats and Republicans, too. I mean, he's in bed with Republicans, and there are Republicans in bed with him. But there's still the Bush's animosity to him is well known. So you still have the right side Trump haters, too. And, look at the way Wallace attacked Trump in the debates. I mean, it's pretty clear that.
Well, look, that first debate, though, Trump was just abominable in that. He was the worst I'd ever seen in that debate. And it made me kind of embarrassed that this guy could be president. Not that I'm so proud of Biden, but He was really unprofessional, is how I would put it, unpresidential. Right. But in the second debate, he did better. But what I would say is, what do you get from Trump that is worth fighting for anyway? Because, you know, the guy has done, in office, he's pretty much done the bidding of the establishment Republican Party anyway. He's passed the best thing he did was a tax bill. So, you know, some tax cuts. Bill Clinton or George Bush could have done those tax cuts, really. You know, Obama could have not only done them, but made them permanent, which is what he did to Bush's tax cuts, right? Mm-hmm. Other than that, what do you got? Some executive orders that were largely overturned, a debacle of a border control policy that was both, I think, immoral and a PR disaster. And recently, a guy who was willing to fall on his sword for the Republican Party by getting Amy Coney Barrett through rather than a stimulus package. That cost him the election, that did. Prioritizing the needs of the long-term needs of the party over his own short-term electoral needs and over the short-term needs, practical needs of his own constituents. So I don't see why there's anything unique about Trump except his personality.
Well, I'll tell you, my take on it would be that the big thing that I want to see out of Trump is smaller government and deconstructing the state. If you look at, you know, I wanted to bring up about big business because I think that one of the big problems with big government is that big business grows up around big government. And if you think about it, let's say you had 50 small businesses. I mean, if you were a politician trying to raise money, which would you rather have to deal with? 50 small businesses, like picture one in each state, or one big business? I mean, you could have 50, I think I did the math, 50, $200,000 businesses where you're trying to raise a little bit of money from all 50 businesses, or one big $100 million company. So what's it going to be easier? It's going to be easier. That's why big government tends to centralize power in these businesses, which is one of the big problems. I mean, if you're looking at it from a capitalist point of view, the whole reason capitalism works is because of competition, because of choice. Competition is like the bad side of that. But competition.
Look, if I wanted to be my own man in politics, I would prefer a bunch of small businesses because I could play them off one another. I may have to go to a lot more people and do a lot more handshaking than I would if it was just one big corporation. But if there's only one or two big corporations and you have to get money from them, then you can't go your own way unless you go directly to the American people to raise money, which is what people are trying to do now.
But that's the thing, the businesses pay because they're getting the government is doing their bidding.
Yeah.
So
sure.
You've got this incestual relationship between business and government.
Yeah, but I'm just saying you asked me what a politician would want.
If
I was a politician, I wouldn't want to have one or two big donors who I have to bow down to. I'd want to have, you know, hundreds, 300 different interest groups that I could play off each other and actually do politics with, right? You give me this, I'll give you that. I think it would be more in their interest to be dealing with a lot more power centers than just one or two. But maybe I'm wrong on that. The other thing is, I don't think that the concentration of power and money is a result of corruption, but I think it's built into the kind of system we're living in, that capital tends to accumulate. You know, that's the Marxist line. We may not come to an agreement about that ever, but maybe you can come back on and we can.
Yeah, I'd like to come back on and talk more about that. But again, that's what I'm getting from Trump is just, I mean, even if you look at the fact that you assume he's incompetent, that in itself would be deconstructing of the government. And every time the federal government would fail to do something, that means the states or the individuals are going to have to step up and pick up the pace. So it's kind of fundamental to me that you want choice. That's fundamental to capitalism. It's so important. It's important in business. It's as important in government. I mean, look at North Korea. The reason North Koreans are in such bad shape is because they have no choice.
That's true.
So you want choice. That's what the whole the idea of the American system is, where the power is kept down at the states, and that gives
I don't,
you choice.
I disagree with the thing about I'm not someone who thinks that the first step should be kind of neoliberal or Reagan style deconstruction of government. I'm also not someone who thinks, oh, what's best for the working class is for there to be a massive expansion of the state either. I have a strange relationship to the state. In fact, I don't think I could tell you precisely. I like state policies that help working people gain security and power, and I don't like state policies that don't. That's how I look at it. But
even though you're looking at it, I'm sorry, go ahead.
But putting that aside for a moment, the differences in perspective on what we want from the government, I would definitely say that I would like to believe that I live in a country where when people vote, you know, it matters that that you can't just cheat the entire election, that, you know, I'm willing to look kind of turn my head away from small scale voter suppression and small scale vote manipulation. Right. And say, okay, that's so usually so marginal. It doesn't flip anything. It doesn't matter. And when it might, I would like to have recounts and audits and the courts do their job. Right.
Well, if we could back up a sec and think about the fact that because the central government is so much bigger than it was supposed to be under the founders' vision, the stakes for controlling that power have become so great that, I mean, you can imagine if we didn't have a central government, if we had a constitutional government the way the founders imagined it, we wouldn't have this.
Yeah.
This stakes for power. So we don't have that. We have a huge government and everybody's trying to get to that all powerful, you know, power base. And you're seeing the fighting coming everywhere from that. You know, the Supreme Court justices are
but the consequence in this, the consequence in this case though, is that you're putting Joe Biden in who at a point where he won't have a Democratic Senate, he'll have less support in the Congress. He himself doesn't have the full support of his own party. The party is fractured. He doesn't have much of a political agenda. The agenda he has is closer to what you're talking about than it is to like what Bernie Sanders would be talking about, meaning like it's going to be – he's known for protecting business and cutting – being willing to cut social spending. And, you know, I think you probably wouldn't like this part any more than I do, for supporting American adventures around the globe and for a lot of foreign intervention. But he's not going to be a big change of pace. And I don't think he has a calculated agenda any more than that's much deeper than Trump's, really.
Yeah. And
or so different.
I can see that you're just as unhappy about Biden as compared to Bernie, but I'm the same way with Trump. Trump is, you know, I'm a small government guy. Trump is a big government guy. I mean, he uses that government power, which I find very interesting that you have a guy who's using power to deconstruct power. I mean, look at Gorsuch, who is a textualist. I mean, if you want to expand power, if you want to become a Hitler, like the accusations go, why would you install a original textualist, constitutional textualist to the Supreme Court? You wouldn't.
Yeah, clearly no, he's not. He's not Hitler. Trump is not Hitler. Let's agree that Trump is not Hitler. He wasn't.
And he's probably not even into those subtleties. I mean, he's, you know, taking advice on that. He probably doesn't really know maybe the subtleties of that. I don't know.
He just, what he knows is that Gorsuch would help him politically.
I certainly personally wouldn't be a huge Trump fan. I mean, not only kind of his playboy ways, we'll call it, but also the whole idea of consumerism. You know, so I would look to someone like Ron Paul or even Rand Paul as more my ideal. So we're kind of in the same boat there. But basically, if you're looking at a choice, if you look at where the stakes are, that things, the government has got so out of control, so huge, they're definitely enriching the ruling class. I mean, talk about the Biden stuff a little bit. Do we really need to know any more than the fact that Hunter Biden was getting paid $80,000 a month? I mean, does anybody not know what's going on there?
No, I mean, obviously.
Of course.
They did that because they thought they could get access to U.S. power by employing this kid.
I mean, exactly.
The same reason he got on the board at Amtrak. It was a payback, some sort of pork. His reason for being on the board for Amtrak, the reason they hired him was that he knew a lot about trains because he rode on them a lot. I mean, it's just ridiculous.
This is all big government. Why, you know, as our government was imagined by our founders, we don't need big government. That's the whole thing. You have free market.
But Trump has been just as corrupt as Biden and more blatantly so. Because, you know, foreign governments will rent whole floors of his hotel in order to gain favor with him. They don't use them. They're just sort of paying him directly or indirectly. But, you know, there's been many instances where Trump has made it clear that to get access to him, you need to kind of pay to play. And he does it very openly, and their nepotism is very open. I can't point to all the examples, but I don't think there's a big difference between Trump and Biden in terms of corruption. In fact, I think Trump is more obviously corrupt than Biden.
You know, I couldn't really say. I think the way this stuff kind of shakes out is we won't really know for sure until looking back on it.
Right. I think we have to learn to live with epistemic humility, right? And say, okay, we have courts of law. We have legal teams representing Trump. We have the American political system. And, you know, we should expect that Trump will pursue recounts and audits in the courts because it's very close. We shouldn't begrudge him that. But we should also accept the results of that, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I really do think that once we get a president. I really do think that we all need to, everybody in the country needs to get together and pull in the same direction. I mean, it's so devastating that the Democrats spent 4 years trying to investigate him, trying to impeach him. Trump is known to be very transactional. I mean, by the Democrats running from him and just refusing to do anything, they're basically running him into the arms of the Republicans. I mean, Trump can't do this by himself. He can't drain the swamp. He needs people. And if the Democrats were open, he was transactional enough that he might have jumped on board. He's progressive. He's not progressive in the sense of big government. He's for using big government power.
Mm-hmm.
So I just think it's. And you can look back on Obama where similar things were going on with him, where they, you know, they just would not play ball with him at all. So it's not like this is new.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I know.
It's something we got to get past. But that gets us back
to definitely the Democrats shouldn't have. From my perspective, the Democrats used Russiagate as an example, not only to attack Trump, but also to control their own left, because it was a way to talk about what was wrong with Trump without having to face the need to change the Democratic Party into something more like a workers' party, right? Where they would actually meet people's needs. They lost big swaths of their base because their base were dying of opioid addiction and unemployment. They didn't see any reason to vote for Democrats. And they liked this guy who said, look, I'm going to bring jobs back. And rather than have to face that, they said, oh, no, he's a Russian agent and he's Hitler. So, yeah. And it was
we got to break this cycle, right? I would, if Biden wins, then, we all need to get behind Kamala. You know,
that's a better bill. I can do that. Go ahead.
I still see the way out of this is starting to shrink government. And even if you look at Bernie, I mean, Bernie is still what is proposed there is just huge expansions in government. I mean, we can quibble about the amounts, that whether it's 60 trillion or 30 trillion or over the 10 years or whatever
I don't think we're going to necessarily agree about the solutions, certainly not right now, but I want to ask you, like, there's a lot of fear, I think, on the left that Trump is going to refuse to leave, and that if he does lose, that his supporters, like the Pepe crowd or whatever, or the Proud Boys, are going to take to the streets, and there's going to be bloodshed, and there might be even some sort of attempted coup. The more paranoid people would say that. Would you agree that both the left and the right in America need to accept that we, in this moment, need to accept that we have a process, and that as much as they may hate Trump, he has the right to pursue recounts and audits in the state courts. And by the same token, Trump supporters need to accept the outcomes.
That's a toughie for me. If we can dip back into the conspiracy theory.
Okay, go into the conspiracy theory for a minute.
I'm not a conspiracy theorist. That's not something I'm into heavy. You know, I would, I kind of see myself as a skeptic mainly, but also in the middle between friends of mine who are big QAnon fans on the far right and people like you on the far left. You know, I really think that if you concede the fact that both sides are lying, it's not like there's one channel anywhere that you can tune in there and they're going to tell you the truth. If both sides are lying, the only way to know is by listening to both sides.
Well, yeah, that's for sure.
Each side is very good at exposing the lies of the other side. Mm-hmm. So by listening to both sides and checking up, you know, if the left makes an accusation, you can go back, you can kind of see what the right's saying about it. And so to get that truth, and again, I forgot where I was going with this.
Yeah. Well, you're going to talk about QAnon.
Oh, yeah, QAnon. Mm-hmm. So what I heard about QAnon is that there was going to be a military coup before Trump, that there were elements in the government that were so fed up with how corrupt things were that they were just going to do that. And Trump actually provided them with an opportunity to take power and start to try to unwind that. Legitimately.
Mm-hmm.
So now that Trump's getting kicked out, I mean, certainly.
Let me see if I get this right. You're saying that the military was so fed up with the corruption of the politicians who, let's say they were friends, too friendly with Epstein, right? That the military was going to throw these corrupt pedophiles out of office. There's going to be a military coup to get rid of this group. But instead, we didn't have to have that because Trump got elected and he was going to do the job for them that they would be doing.
That is something I heard, yes.
Okay.
So,
well, you know, let me tell you from my left perspective how that sounds. First of all, well, I don't deny Epstein exists and that their corruption in government existed. And who knows what we'd find out about Bill Clinton if that was all ever fully come to light, or what we'd find out about Trump, who also was friendly with Epstein and also was been charged of. I think there was a 13-year-old girl who charged Trump for rape, or alleged that had happened, and tried to bring it to court, and it kind of never happened. I don't know if that's true. I don't know what Bill Clinton has done. I don't deny that something's hinky there. But when you start to think that it's justified to have a military coup to get rid of corruption and install basically a dictatorship in an effort to get rid of the bad people, that to me is profoundly un-American, anti-democratic, and to be avoided. I mean, I don't trust an authoritarian coup more than I trust even the halfway corrupt political system that we have in the courts and elites that we have. I would rather see Epstein go to trial And, you know, I know he was probably murdered, but now there's still a chance for the investigation to continue. I'd push for that. I would not accept a dictatorship instead.
Well, I would certainly agree that I wouldn't hope for it, but I would be on the fence, and I would disagree. I would think it's uniquely American and built into our system, that our laws allow or even prepare for problems. And it comes back to checks and balances. I mean, there's a check for, we strive to have a check for every balance, and the ultimate check against the government is armed populace that's going to.
Yeah, well, you weren't talking about that. You're talking about a military coup. The U.S. military and that elites within the U.S. military using the military against the American public and the American government. It's not the same thing as a populist revolt from below. Right?
Well, elements of the military. So, yeah. But
I mean,
so am I to the point where, I mean, I certainly wouldn't want to see civil war. I would like to see things. But I mean, we are getting to the point where it's hard to how can we go on? The corruption is so blatant. Part of the problem is there's just no consequences for this. It's like a big game to them where they just, you know, they'll send in their special prosecutor and, you know, steer the Congress after Trump and for years, spend millions and millions of dollars. And we find out that it was all made up and it was a fraud. And you caught us and we're on to the next thing. You know, heads ought to be rolling for this. People ought to be going to jail.
What makes this moment worse than Watergate, say? What makes the corruption going on now worse than what we might have, than what was going on at the time of JFK? What makes this historically different than the rest of the very complicated and messy and not always even just or, always somewhat corrupt history of the United States? Why is this so different?
You know, I would go back to the lack of competition. You know, we're locked into a duopoly that where you basically have two parties that pick. I mean, so yeah, we vote, but we're basically voting between two that have been picked by the parties, and both of them are in the pockets of.
But there's never been a time in U.S. history where we had three really vibrant political parties, right? There's always been kind of a choice between two. They haven't always been the same two. When the founders started, they didn't even want parties. So I don't see this as historically a moment where the principles of democratic participation and accountability and checks and balances should be thrown over in service of a military coup. What makes that seem like it's reasonable is the invocation of this pedophilic threat. It's the depth of that, you know, the terribleness of what I would think to be at a certain level, even though there's some truth to it, certain level of sort of an imaginary threat, it becomes overblown in people's imaginations.
I wouldn't want to focus on that. What I would want to focus on is where we are with the media, where we are with the things that they're getting away with. And you can look at the rising income gap to where the government has just become a way for the ruling class to enrich themselves. Yeah. And you can look at a graph and know that. I mean, when you have, look at the big tech censorship. I mean, this is, you know, we saw these guys get hauled into the Congress and admit that, you know, the guy from Dorsey, he admitted that he was wrong. Mm-hmm. So this is going on. I mean, the Flynn stuff, the mainstream media is still ignoring this.
Yeah.
So we are to this point. I mean, think about the importance of all the tenets of the constitutional system, you know, freedom of information, freedom of speech. We don't have that anymore. We have.
Well, I tell you, we do have some freedom of speech because this is going to be going on YouTube. Right.
Well, that's true.
Yeah. And in fact, in some ways, we have more freedom of speech because we can make it ourselves more easily.
That's true, but it's lost. And this is a small platform. It gets lost as compared to Twitter, who's banning a newspaper article.
Well,
from
right.
The fourth largest newspaper.
No, I totally agree with you that Twitter and Facebook and YouTube potentially could become censorious in ways that we can't accept. And I don't know what we'll do when that happens. But one thing that I think that is really important, and I want to wrap up our conversation because we've been talking for about an hour and a half now. But
okay. One
thing that I think is really important is that people like you and me don't stop talking to each other, even though we have ideological and political differences. Because this was what was nice about this conversation was we weren't shouting. We didn't get, and I'm nicer in person, and you're nicer in person than you are on Facebook, right?
It's easy to get out of hand on there.
Yeah.
So my apologies.
No, you were fine, but I'm just saying, like, we both communicate better when we talk like this and try to be nice to each other and move ahead than we do when we're fighting on social media. And that's worth noting because that means that social media divides people. And that means that the people will be less effective when they're divided. So
I agree. It's so important. And I'm glad we were able to sit down as being on completely opposite scales and have a conversation.
Thanks for watching this Zero Books video. If you enjoyed it, subscribe to this channel and click on the notifications bell so that you'll be alerted whenever we release a new video. You should also consider supporting us on Patreon. Our patrons get access to our Inside Zero Books podcast every week and can get access to the Zero Books Book Club and help us to continue making online content from the left.